You're listening to Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness, a podcast about domestic violence, sponsored by Randy's House of Angels. Domestic or intimate partner violence is a complex and silent epidemic that affects millions of people worldwide. To respond to the overwhelming issues associated with domestic violence, Randy's House of Angels has produced a series of podcasts that will bring this epidemic to the forefront of public consciousness and break the silence that often shrouds it. This is Paul Miller, producer of this program, and by creating a dedicated platform, Randy's House of Angels hopes to create a safe space for survivors, advocates, and experts to share their stories, insights, and knowledge. A series of topics will be discussed that can offer vital support and resources to victims and survivors, helping them realize that they are not alone and that there is help available. It can also serve as a catalyst for raising awareness and fostering necessary conversations within families, communities, and institutions to empower individuals, foster empathy, and inspire collective action toward eradicating domestic violence while creating a safer, more compassionate society. We invite you to access the podcast by going to randyshouseofangels.org. Today, we are discussing the stigma surrounding mental health and how it can prevent victims from seeking help. How domestic violence impacts the mental health of survivors, including PTSD, depression, and anxiety. We will look at the role of mental health professionals in identifying and supporting victims and the need for greater awareness and education among law enforcement, healthcare providers, and social workers. Identifying what are the strategies to promote mental wellness in survivors and prevent further trauma, and how supportive communities and networks can foster healing for both victims and their families, along with approaches to therapy and recovery for survivors. Joining us today is Tony Shearer. Tony Shearer has been providing counseling and leadership in human and social services for 31 years. She earned a Master's of Arts degree in counseling psychology with a concentration in marriage and family therapy in 1991. Despite an ongoing passion and commitment for working with children and adults who identify with being abused, professional circumstances created opportunity for her to become additionally specialized in working with adult sexual offenders, youth with problematic sexual behaviors, and perpetrators of family violence. Tony is a licensed professional counselor in Pennsylvania who is specialized in sexual and family violence and trained in trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, attachment, motivational interviewing, and mindfulness. She is a certified clinical trauma professional, child and adolescent trauma professional, and certified family trauma professional. The facilitator of today's podcast is Dr. Ellen Smith. Ellen Smith, MD, retired after 30 years of teaching and practicing family medicine in the Harrisburg area. Her undergraduate studies were at Hollins University, and she completed her medical degree at the Penn State University College of Medicine in Hershey, PA. In addition, she completed a family medicine residency at Lancaster General Hospital. Since retiring, she has studied adversity, how a traumatized brain works, and how to bounce back and become more resilient. She is passionate and appreciative of the opportunity to educate thousands of people about these topics. She also volunteers at the Trinity Preschool of Harrisburg, a grant-funded, inner-city, trauma-informed preschool. Finally, she has developed a tool called the Personal Resilience Planner, which takes the above concepts and provides a practical way to look at strengths, trauma responses, resilience, and how to progress in these areas over time.
Good morning, Tony. It's so good to see you again. We're glad you're here. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you for having me again. I appreciate being here.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. Today, we're going to talk about the stigma. We're going to start by talking about the stigma of domestic violence, but we're going to expand it beyond those who have violence done against them to those who are violent, those who are battering their partner. And I just wondered if you could expand on that, perhaps start with those who are battered and then move towards those who do the battering.
Sure. And there's a lot of crossover, right, between those who are victimized and those who act out in a violent way. And there's many different ways in which we need to expand this conversation beyond our understanding of when we think of domestic violence. We often think of that first very volatile one, which is the physical. But there are many other facets that we have to look at, including psychological, emotional, right? We have to look at sexual, financial. These are ways in which people control other people. And that's what the conversation is about. But there is a stigma that goes with that, whether you are someone who is victimized or you're someone who acts in those ways. And those stigmas are very similar when it comes to becoming barriers to people getting help. And so some of those include shame. Shame is a very heavy burden to carry. Those who are victimized and those who act out violently oftentimes feel that just big cape of shame. We also have self-blame. Sometimes it's appropriate, right? When we hurt people, it's appropriate to own that. But it's very scary to do that if you don't have a safe place to do so. And then lastly, we also have that element of stigma that creates and is that responsible thing of creating silence. And silence is one of the most dangerous that we look at when we're looking at stigma that people carry.
So tell us a little bit more about the silence from both sides of the equation. Go a little bit more in depth if you can.
Well, silence is often experienced by those who have been harmed in that you try to create a safe space. So people become quiet. They become isolated. They don't want to create a situation that could provoke any kind of violence against them. And again, remember, in any of those categories. So people actually become quiet. But the silence also is, it can be looked at from the perspective of we don't talk about it, or we ignore it, or we know it's happening, but we just don't recognize it. Because if we don't recognize it, then we won't create more attention to it, which means in our mind sometimes and how we twist things, that also it won't create more problem. And but so, silence, like we always say, you're only as sick as your secrets, right? The silence is what creates the continuation of bad behavior.
Excellent. So we talk a lot about the children in these families. Mm-hmm. And can you talk about the silence that they learn or at some point understand that that's something that they must do? Perhaps, you know, what happens in this house stays in this house kind of mentality.
You know, it's really interesting to me in working with families where there's been family violence is that oftentimes it's the unspoken rule that is one of the most dangerous. And what kids often learn is they learn how to be in a situation to, again, minimize any kind of incidents, whether that be for the parent who is often the victim or the parent who is being hurtful. And sometimes it's self-preservation. You learn how not to also be a victim, right? It's hard to see someone that you care about be victimized and be the scapegoat or be the target, but you also are trying to, you know, preserve your own self and you don't want to become that. And that also then creates this guilt that many children have about this is happening to someone I love and I'm not doing anything about it because I really can't, but I also have to preserve myself. So children learn how to be silent based on what they observe more than what they're told. Kids learn a lot through those, you know, those double messages often.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about mental health in those who are victimized as well as those who do harm. Let's think about the mental health of both those who are victims and those who are victimized, and perhaps the issue of mental health before they get in a relationship, during, after. And also, I've heard the term, maybe not a good term, but good and bad pickers. Do people pick people who set them up?
So that's a really great question, and it's a little cumbersome, so we'll try to break it down a little bit if I can. So when it comes to the mental health of someone who grows up or as they're growing up and they start to engage in these behaviors, we have a couple theories on why people do that and kind of what's behind that. So oftentimes, those who are in very powerless positions, for example, they're in homes where there has been some form of domestic violence, they will oftentimes repeat behavior that they've learned. And this, again, can be boys or girls, you know, or those who identify as they, them. It doesn't matter who we're talking about here. So what happens oftentimes is as these young people are growing up in these environments, some children will do what we call identify with the aggressor, that they recognize that there's power to be had in those positions. And we see it sometimes with kids who start to act very similarly to those who have hurt a partner, or not a partner, but a parent. They start to act that same way towards that parent, right? So we see children sometimes aggress towards, if we're looking at the female partner in here as the victim, they start to also act out, become disrespectful, not listen, push them out of the way sometimes, you know, don't hesitate to, you know, if the parent takes the phone, to go after that parent physically. I mean, we've seen these kinds of things in my practice over and over and over again where we know there's family violence. So that happens. So we start to see at younger ages, we see kids start to take on these very similar behaviors because, again, remember, behavior is often learned, right? So we can't forget that. And we have an obligation to our children to teach them respectful behaviors. And when there are families where this is not present, we're not teaching kids how to become respectful, and we're perpetuating that. That's why also in dating violence, we start to see our kids with their partners, right? And we start to see how they interact. And are they being manipulative? Are they being, you know, critical? Are they shaming? You know, these are the things that we start to see early on, and those things will oftentimes continue into adult relationships, sadly. But we also see the flip side of that. And we see, you know, sometimes kids who experience these kinds of environments oftentimes, and I say kids because kids often, it's where it starts. Very rarely will you see an adult offender begin to offend in their adulthood. It doesn't typically happen like that. These behavior patterns have been set long before they become adults. Right? We just happen to maybe observe it differently because they're now on their own and they have other family members, et cetera. But for those who also grow up in these environments or, you know, act out, can do it not only just in those more direct ways, but you also see this is where people kind of become more susceptible to re-victimization as they get older, right? Because these are the ones who become more quiet. These are the ones who often have a lot of trauma. And if they develop these fear responses to these environments. So when you're talking about that question about, you know, the pickers and those who were picked, it's that it becomes a pattern of behavior that you're more comfortable in engaging because it's what you know. It's not because you choose it. It's because it's how you've learned to exist. So oftentimes, those patterns of what was familiar, right, you attract yourself to, and that goes both ways. So if I'm in an environment where perhaps I watched a lot of victimization, I may very well end up in a situation where I also pick a partner who may be violent to me as well, because that's what I know. And oftentimes we don't even realize that until we're in it. And, you know, hopefully we get some kind of help or someone enlightens us to the fact that we've repeated behaviors that we witnessed. And it's through that informed information that we can make different decisions. But these patterns, like I said, begin really, really early on.
That's really helpful. And I think I bring back to the question of the silence, whether it's the victim, him or herself, or their self, or whether it's the person who is committing violence. Both sides mm-hmm. are silent. And so perhaps a person who's a victim wouldn't bring that up. And the same with someone who is violent. Is there more to that that needs to be said or no?
I think, you know, I don't know what else to be said about it except that, you know, it's true. Silence begets silence, whether it's you're creating secrecy because of what you're witnessing and you don't want to have more harm caused, or because you also are engaging in a behavior that is not okay and you know it's not okay, but you don't want other people to know that it's not okay, that you're doing it. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So you keep that silence. So yeah, silence begets silence. That's really how I best can describe that.
Excellent. So in prior podcasts, we've talked about how victims can get help in various mm-hmm. ways. And we've talked a bit about how parents who see their offspring, their child, becoming victimized. So keep that in mind for the looking at the prior podcast. But let's talk about people who are victimizing or causing harm to a partner, or maybe causing harm, and we're talking about intimate partner violence, but perhaps in other relationships, if that seems appropriate, how can they get help?
It requires, so this is really a podium for me, so I appreciate you bringing this up because I'm very passionate about this. I think what ends up happening is in the area of those who batter, okay, people who commit these harmful acts to other people and, again, create these cycles of behavior that we keep repeating generation after generation, is I think that while we have some great programming, the Amend program, for example, is really based on a lot of really good material, but I think it's outdated. And I think a lot of the traditional programs that existed for those who act out violently, one, it's not inviting to female partners who are abusive, it doesn't invite that at all, in fact, which is very frustrating because I, you know, have a lot of women that I work with who have acted out in aggressive ways, and they do want to change those behaviors, but you can't send them out. So it's prompted me to create a program of my own to work with women who have acted violently. And I did the same thing in New Hampshire years ago, like back in the early 90s, when at that time we had we didn't have any parallel programming or equitable program for women who acted out sexually, right? So I created a program that existed for women, but we had to call it a violent offender program in the prison because there weren't enough women who were incarcerated for sex crimes yet were committing sex crimes. So it was really interesting. We have really delayed wanting to recognize that women can act out violently. And part of it is like we go back to in this conversation, which is more and more women are being subjected as children to these violent ways and are learning these violent ways too. So we have to recognize that. Right. So when we recognize it, we can create programming around it. But because most of the programs are traditionally based on men who batter, right, we have really cut out getting help for those who also want help and need it and are women. So that's one piece. The other piece of this, I think, is that there are programs out there, but the material's really, really based on these dynamics from the 1970s and the 1980s when these programs were created when it comes to our understanding of those who batter, right? We're even changing the words right now because we're saying those who batter. So we don't want to define someone by the action, but the programs, the way everything is written, is calling them batterers, calling them perpetrators, calling them these names that most people want to reject immediately and say, that's not me. I don't have that problem. I don't do that, right? When in fact we know they may, but you have to invoke a person where they're at to get them to buy in to understanding and taking a look at their behavior. A lot of the work we do, which I understand the benefit of this, for men who batter or the traditional programming that exists for them, is done in groups, right? And there's a lot of value to that because it is based on that mentality of, you know, being kind of like judged by your peers and helping within that whole element. When you look at people who've grown up in situations where trust is an issue, we have PTSD, we have anxiety, we have all those things, we're not going to reach that group as easily unless they're court mandated, right? They're not going to volunteer to sign up to go into a group of people where they're going to look at wanting to not be a part of, saying, you know, I'm in denial, I'm not like these other people, when in fact they are. So we have to blend in that work of individual work. You know, we also have to look at group work. There's benefits, but it shouldn't be all one way. And that's part of the problem I find with the work that is done for folks who really want to get help for this really, you know, harmful behavior.
Absolutely.
It costs about $400 to send a child to Randy's Camp or Randy's Kids Club. If you are interested in sponsoring a child, please contact Nancy Chavez at 717-503-4498 or email randyshouseofangels@gmail.com for more information.
So let's think of someone who has had, someone or many people who have had behavior that involves battering or violence. I wonder if people are worried that that information will then go to the court system and cause them to be incarcerated or whatever. But you have a relationship with the person and you may not report that.
That is true. I mean, there are people who, again, we go back to the silence, right? We go back to the fact that oftentimes people aren't going to want other people to know that. And there is a fear factor there. And it's legitimate, right? It's legitimate in that if, you know, it is found out that you are harming people, you may be held accountable, whether it be through children and youth services, it might be through the police, depending on, you know, who typically will report. Sometimes neighbors hear things that are of concern, and reports go in. So people are frightened of that. But I think it's really important that, you know, we have to look at accountability in that it is reflected much better on a person when they say, you know what, I recognize that these behaviors are not okay, and what I'm doing to someone makes me feel really, really bad about myself. in some element. I mean, I did work, now it's not been recent, but I have worked with men and women who've committed violent crimes. I have. That's kind of the wheelhouse that I really started my profession in. And I can tell you that of the majority of people that I've worked with, not one of them has ever, well, I can lie on that, in that I've had very few, and we're talking like a small percentage, less than 3% of those that I've worked with have ever walked away saying, you know, this, I didn't do anything wrong. This wasn't, you know, this was justified. Most people know inherently when they've crossed those lines and when they know that their behavior is not okay. And what we need to do is start empowering people to recognize that when you start taking responsibility, it's better to do it before you're in the criminal justice system versus after, right? But it's scary to do that, you know, and we go back to the stigma. People talk about mental health being a weakness. The truth is when people seek treatment and they seek help, the courage that people have is so immense, whether it be for this kind of behavior, okay, that we're talking about where you're hurting people in those vast ways that we discussed, or you're being victimized. We have to stop that understanding that it's a weakness, it's courage, it's courageousness. In fact, that's what the program is called that I created for women. It's courage, because that's what it takes to really look at yourself and look at these patterns that were established long before you got into this romantic relationship.
So for those out there who are listening, who may say to themselves, I have had violent behavior, I have taken advantage of a partner. Are there thoughts to pass on to them to help them to go from that behavior to getting help?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, first of all, there is a specialization when you're working with people who've committed, you know, violent acts or harmful acts. You know, you really want to find a provider who is experienced in that. I would also not only like to invite those who are in those situations, but the providers to also think outside the box, right? And start to look at ways of addressing these behaviors maybe differently than how they've been. You know, using other, there's tons of resources out there. We don't have to just stick to curriculum. We can find and mold what works for a person as their needs are identified, right? And I think if we can do that, our providers will become more varied and more specialized. And yeah, I think you reach out and when you reach out for help, you ask, is there anyone who specializes in family violence? Those are the words I'd use. You know, I am someone who has, you know, acted in a way that's violently that I want to change. Those are the conversations to have when you're trying to get help.
That's good information. And I come from a medical side, from a primary care side. So consider a physician who has a patient who describes these behaviors. That person, that physician or nurse practitioner or PA should call their psychological resources and say the same thing. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think we stop sharing our concerns and trying to get help for people, regardless of if we know someone who's perpetrated or someone who's, again, been victimized. And sometimes it's a little bit of both. But yeah, I mean, I think we professionally still owe it to our those we're treating, that we need to elevate the concern and have the conversation and pull in people with resources. Whether or not someone takes on that challenge at this point in time is irrelevant. You know, sometimes our job is really to plant those seeds and see how it grows, because it might not be able to be something they can take on now, but I promise you, you will be changing the trajectory at that point by just even setting the awareness that this is not okay.
Excellent. And you said about, we've talked more so about male-female relationships. Mm-hmm. Are there things to be said about same-sex relationship or trans or that type of thing?
Absolutely. Violence can happen in any relationship, right? And again, violence being physical violence, sexual violence, emotional, psychological, and financial. Any relationship can have that. So yes, this is not, and please understand, this is not just traditionally male to female. And that's again why we have to do better, right? We have to have programs for women. We have to have programs for those who are also victimized. You know, we have to do better by that too, you know, and trying to empower people versus, you know, try to label them and focus on, you know, shaming them. That style of treatment is out. It's gone. That's an old way of behaving, and we have to do better by that.
Yes, and we'll have another podcast forthcoming about juvenile. We have a juvenile probation officer and leader in the juvenile probation area of Pennsylvania, and he talks about that changed as well as in terms of juvenile probation. It's not punitive. It's behaviorally oriented. And what is the behavior and how to, where did it come from and how to change the behavior to more healthy and effective relationships. And I think that's important.
It's very important. And truthfully, you know, this whole restorative justice understanding is really, I think, the route to go.
Yes.
Which is really about accountability, but it's also projecting change. And you do that through the fact that you're not shaming people and, you know, punishing. Again, accountability is one thing, but how we go about that and how we treat people, we really have to do better by that.
I agree completely. That's wonderful. Let's turn back to some of the types of violence, the emotional, the physical. Those seem sort of clear to me. What about the financial violence? How might that look?
Oh, well, it can be the traditional ways of we understand control of someone's finances, right? Not combining combining your resources, being told that you will give money to someone, that, you know, we're talking about partnerships here, right? We're talking about relationships, whether it be dating relationships or not. The person who is who it's understood that they will be giving a portion of their, you know, their pay to this person. I mean, again, you kind of think about it and you're like, does this really happen? But it really, truly does. Destroying people's things, you know, that's a financial responsibility that happens, and we see it all the time where that is something that is used, and some of that is financially just not even something you can replicate depending on what they're damaging. I've seen it with like apartments, like you go in and you do damage because one, not only are you going to have to repair the damage, but you can also lose the home you're in, especially if you're a renter, right? So if I want to really harm someone and make them feel afraid, I'm going to go in and create damage that might take their stability away, their safety away, those primary needs that we have, create harm that if that's talked about, and then we go back to the whole silence, right, that they know that they may be evicted. And that's a very scary place for someone to be, especially if they have children. So that's how the financial looks. So it's beyond just, it's stealing. It's also going in someone's purse or someone's wallet and taking money out. Those are ways that we can, again, financially harm another person.
And this is taking things as opposed to perhaps a couple would sit down and look at their finances and agree that you pay half the rent and I pay half the rent. That's an agreement, that's a negotiation, and it's agreed upon. But in this case, we're talking about one person is saying, demanding, in fact, they've got to do this or they've got to do that.
Or they're not going to have the relationship. I an example that I had actually recently is there's a woman that I've worked with and her partner. It's a very sad situation. But anyway, she's a lot younger than he is. And he doesn't have a vehicle, but she does, right? He doesn't work, but she does. So again, when we're talking about a couple, I want to clarify that quickly before I wrap back around here. But sometimes couples will sit down and they'll decide that you're going to pay half of everything. But yet the one person is making, you know, a quarter of what the other person's making and still expecting them to come up with half of the utilities is not going to, and the expenses is could still be, you know, a form of financial abuse. So we have to be careful about that, that it's based on equity, based on what you can contribute to the relationship, right? I might come with a quarter of the amount of money, but I also might then be responsible for doing some other things around the house that you don't have to do. And that's how we make it equal, right? And
yes.
we have it talked about. But in this one case that I was talking to you about, so what he does is he takes her to work so that he gets her car. So he runs her car. He doesn't put gas in it. She's responsible for that. And he sometimes doesn't show up to pick her up on time. So she has to wait, you know, half hour, 45 minutes till he comes to get her. That is another form of what we're talking about when we're talking about the financial abuse, that you're taking advantage of someone who has something that you might not have and using it for your own selfish gain and not considering the other person.
That's very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about resources. We want to make sure that with this podcast, people have resources, and we'll put that on the Randy's House of Angels page with the podcast. But are there resources, and you mentioned a couple, mm-hmm. maybe you can highlight them or other things that it would be good for people, because a lot of folks will go to the internet to find resources so that they don't have to make phone calls because of the stigma and the silence.
There is resources, and you can, I look at several areas. So programs that I know of that exist, Cumberland Perry, you have through the domestic violence programming. They are, and I love this about them. This is the forward movement to me of the Cumberland Perry domestic violence programming, that they actually are trying to provide services for those who've acted out in violent ways. So that's the Amend program. And I did express, you know, what I thought about, you know, just the way that they advertise themselves. And unfortunately, I think we're kind of clipping people who could benefit there. But anyway, so that's a resource, is the Amend program. I have the Courage to Change program, which is for women who've acted out violently. It is more individualized at this point, but I would love to see it become, you know, more of a group. And then you can also go through some of your help networks like you have in each county. I would definitely encourage people to check that out and get those resources through, like, the connections that the helpline. I think it's the helpline, actually, that can give all those resources. Because there are so providers that pop up that I don't necessarily know of right now who might have those specializations. But, you know, again, those resources are there. And if they're not there, you know, I think it's important to elevate that up, you know, elevate that up to MHIDD programs in your county and let them know that this is a lack of service, because they're very good about trying to find these kinds of programs when a need has been identified.
And what's MHID?
Mental health, intellectual disabilities. Each county has an MHIDD program that exists. And so, you know, elevating those concerns to them and having them help to find these programs can be really, really helpful.
And is it true that every county in Pennsylvania, or counties perhaps, have domestic violence services or resources?
They do. For victims, yes. Not so for those who perpetrate violence, though.
So should a person who has violent behavior call domestic violence in their county, if that's appropriate, or look towards the helpline or another place?
You know, now that you're saying this, because you were mentioning about probation too, probation would be, even if you're not on a form of probation, it might be another caveat, because they would know of some services in their county for those who have acted in violent ways. But oftentimes those people have been through the criminal justice system, but still they'll know of some programs. But back to what you asked, my only concern with that is that oftentimes what ends up happening is that some domestic violence programs are not as open to really helping those who have acted out in violent ways, because they've been very passionate about helping those who have been victimized. So there's a divide sometimes. Cumberland Perry, for example, I would know would provide that service, that they would tell you how to get a hold of the Amend program. I can't confidently say that about every program, but you don't lose hope. You just keep asking these questions if you can till you get the service that you need.
Right. And that's part of the reason we open this up, because there are places that we don't know or may not have those services, and then we need to push for them.
That's right.
And so in our last couple of minutes, are there things that you'd like to highlight or things that we didn't discuss that you want to mention?
I think that reminding folks that change is possible. Right? It is. It's possible. And we function every day with that hope of change. So it doesn't matter, you know, if you've been harmed or you're harming people, it doesn't have to continue. We can stop that. And we have the capability to do it. There are supports out there. Again, you just have to look for them or help create them. But the bottom line is that people can change. And I believe in humanity. I believe in the power of people. I think our families can get stronger. I think we can stop tolerating this kind of behavior and excusing it. Stop the silence. We've got to stop the silence, right? We got to do better.
We've got to do better, yes. Thank you so much, Toni.
You're welcome.
Randy's House of Angels is sponsoring Season 3 of a series of podcasts that will serve as a resource to anyone impacted by domestic violence, including parents, guardians, caseworkers, health providers, advocates, teachers, trauma specialists, clinicians, and more, to provide an overview of domestic violence and how to handle situations where domestic violence is present. Season 3 will include a series of 5 podcasts that will include an overview in addressing the mental health stigma in domestic violence situations, the influence of pop culture on domestic violence, looking at the harmful tropes and changing narratives, and addressing trauma-informed juvenile probation and breaking the cycle for youth. The podcast will include testimony and stories from experts that work in the domestic violence field, criminal justice, juvenile justice, and social work academia. The podcast will be broadcasted starting in August of 2025 and run through October of 2025. Go to Randy's House of Angels website at randyshouseofangels.org. There, you can catch up on any podcast you've missed, find additional resources that support the podcasts, and we encourage you to click on the link and take our short survey. Your feedback is essential to shaping and informing future episodes of this show.